It is hour number three of midday with Trey and BK. Brad Kellner, no longer a part of the show. Not in general, just today. He is about to head out with his boys in Atlanta to try and have themselves some fun before the championship game tonight. At 12:50, we will crosstalk it with Rod Babers ahead of the Rodcast from 1 to 3. And shooting the bull at 12:30, more evidence that when the computers wage war on humans, it's going to be a one-sided affair. And joining us here in a couple of minutes, it will be Seth Emerson. He covers Georgia sports for Dog Nation and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution to talk about tonight's big championship game. In the meantime, Specs text line is 337-3776. If you would like to contribute, I am all ears and eyes, as it were, at this point. And we will talk some national championship game. The Crimson Tide opened up as a 5.5-point favorite in Vegas over the Georgia Bulldogs. Currently, that is at 3.5, and that is in large part because of two things. One, what Nick Saban has built over time in Tuscaloosa, and then secondly, the performance that you saw versus the Clemson Tigers last week when Alabama really dominated that game. On the defensive side, it wasn't an offensive domination for the Crimson Tide. They had the defensive score. They had another turnover that led to a short field. And because of that, the score looked a little bit more lopsided than the game itself actually was. To get some thoughts right now on these things and more, joining us on the Vaqueros Cafe and Cantina Hotline, it is Seth Emerson. As I said, he covers Georgia sports for Dog Nation and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Follow him on Twitter, at Seth W. Emerson. Seth, thank you so much for the time. How you doing today?
Oh, you know, getting ready for a national championship game that will be attended by the President of the United States. So just, you know, normal Monday.
Right. So what does the game day normally entail for you, and how is that process any different heading into tonight's affair, which, as you just said, is going to decide who college football's national champion for this past season is?
Well, it's all a little surreal, this whole thing. I mean, it's funny. I hung out with some Alabama writers last night, and I've been hanging out with them a little bit here at stuff, and this is old hat to them. They're like, yeah, you know, this is what we do. It's just kind of what we do. For us, it's like, this is all new. And last week we were in Los Angeles playing a team that, you know, we're not very acquainted with. Georgia and Oklahoma had never played. So it was a new stadium, a new locale, a new opponent. And now we're right back here in Atlanta, just over an hour away from our houses in Athens, and playing Alabama, a team that, you know, there's so many storylines, so much overlap between the two programs that we couldn't fit all the storylines in 1 week. You know, it's just the whole thing's a little surreal. We do finally know that the season ends tonight. That's the one thing we know. We just don't know whether it's going to be the program's first championship in 37 years or not.
So is the biggest storyline for you, Seth, is it Saban versus Kirby Smart, considering how long Kirby worked for Nick Saban, or is it SEC versus SEC for the championship?
It's Kirby versus Saban. I mean, SEC versus SEC has happened. There's just so much. I know nationally it could be SEC fatigue. Maybe the ratings for this game aren't going to be that good. I know if I were, you know, still a casual college football fan as I was growing up in the Washington, D.C. area, I probably wouldn't be too interested in this. I would have been more interested in Oklahoma against Alabama. But here it's monumental. It's huge. Georgia hired Kirby, not just because he was an alum. That was part of it, but also because of Nick Saban's success. And they said, well, we can't hire Saban, obviously, but what if we get his top lieutenant, who just happens to be a Georgia guy, and try to repeat the process in capital letters? And they feel like they've done that.
And we've all seen the statistics cited over and over again, that Nick Saban is undefeated versus his former assistants in his career. What makes Kirby Smart and his Georgia Bulldogs football team different in terms of being able to break that win streak for Nick Saban?
Yeah, that stat is one I kind of discount. I don't put much into that. And I'm somebody who does look at history for some, you know, like earlier in the season, for instance, I looked at Kirby's history as Alabama's defensive coordinator against Mississippi State. If people think back, that the Georgia-Mississippi State game was a big national game at the time, wondering if Georgia was for real, Mississippi State was for real. Some people were picking Mississippi State. I was looking at the history of it, of Kirby's success in stopping Dan Mullen offenses, and saying, I think Georgia's going to win, and they could win pretty handily. Hmm. And they did. I don't look at the 11-0 Nick Saban record against former assistants very much, because I think they were favored in all those games. I mean, I think the one matchup that was, you know, kind of close on paper going into it was when Jimbo Fisher was coaching Florida State. And that was earlier this year. But otherwise, you know, people have tried to repeat the process and they haven't been able to do it. So Nick Saban was taking his powerful Alabama team against teams that were overmatched, like Will Muschamp at Florida and South Carolina, Jim McElwain at Florida, and some other cases. I think Georgia is a lot closer in talent to Alabama than most any of those teams had been, with the, you know, Florida State earlier this year being one exception, and they lost their quarterback early in the game. That doesn't mean that I kind of throw out that there's a psychological factor that could help here. I mean, everybody knows each other. You know, that not only did Kirby come over here and bring several assistants who, you know, have Alabama ties, who know the roster at Alabama inside and out. Alabama has Jeremy Pruitt, defensive coordinator, who knows Georgia's roster inside and out. So I think there's just so much overlap on both sides, it just kind of cancels itself out.
And one of those similarities is Nick Saban recruited Jake Fromm to play quarterback for him at Alabama. Of course, he ends up choosing the Bulldogs. He is a Georgia kid. We've really seen him develop throughout the year, not only as somebody who is a game manager, but also as a guy who can really make plays when it comes down to it. We saw that in the game-tying drive versus Oklahoma last weekend in the Rose Bowl. Where are you with Jake Fromm's development right now at the position, and do you think he is capable enough to help lead the Bulldogs to a victory tonight?
Yeah, I think he is. I don't want to – I mean, the kid's just made a believer out of me. I was someone who was skeptical before the season began, thought when Jacob Eason got hurt, you know, that would be not a death knell to Georgia, but it would, you know, you're throwing a true freshman out there. But Jake Fromm's just got that kind of it factor. He makes the right throws. He makes the right decisions. He's, you know, a good game manager in the best sense of the term. He recognizes what the defense is doing, and he checks out of the right plays. He'll check from a run play to a pass play to run play, a run play to a different run play. He does all those things. And that's why Georgia's here now. I mean, you knew Georgia could run the ball with Chubb and Michelle and DeAndre Swift, but when they have to pass the ball, with the exception of the first Auburn game, they have. And Fromm's a big part of that. Now, he's going to face his toughest opponent. The entire offense is going to face its toughest defense of the year, clearly. I mean, Auburn's tough with everything, except maybe pass rush. But best secondary Jake Fromm's faced, best front seven and run defense that Nick Chubb and Sony Michel and company have faced. So they've been great. You know, they've done what was needed on offense this year, but they get their toughest test tonight.
So is there a biggest key that you see for this Georgia offense in finding success against such a talented Crimson Tide D?
You know, I think they've got to be able to do both. They've got to be able to run and pass. I think if they're able to run the ball a little bit, then, you know, look, Auburn stopped them the first time around in that game at Auburn. They couldn't run the ball, and therefore they couldn't pass the ball. If Alabama is able to shut down Georgia's run game the way Auburn did, then it's going to be a long day, because Georgia can pass the ball, but they, I don't know that they can pass the ball 35, 40 times a game. They can't do it at will. They pass to kind of set up the run, not the other way around. So the key is if Georgia is able to get, you know, 3 to 4 yard chunks and then an occasional like 10 to 12 yard run, then I think that's going to put Georgia in a really good position to win this game. I just don't know that that'll happen.
Seth Emerson covers Georgia sports for Dog Nation and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Follow him on Twitter at Seth W. Emerson. Switching sides of the ball now, Seth. This Georgia defense is one that is, at least on paper and also looking at the outcomes this year, looks to be as talented as what Alabama does on that side of the ball. Even though they struggled in the first half versus Oklahoma, their aggressiveness in the second half really helped set a tone that allowed the Dogs to come back versus the Sooners. Do you see this Georgia defense as one that will be able to contain an Alabama running game that was so good, even against a talented Clemson defensive line last week, and really setting the physical tone? Even though the running backs didn't have outwardly impressive games, I think they averaged somewhere just over 3 yards a carry, they were able to control the clock enough to allow their offense to then do enough to actually win that game. Do you think Georgia's defense will be able to win those battles more often than not?
Right. I mean, it's the same thing as the other side of the ball. If Alabama and Damian Harris and Bo Scarborough are able to get those kind of 3 to 4 yard chunks, and Jalen Hurts is able to be accurate, he hasn't thrown many interceptions this year, just one, but you know, he misses on some deep balls sometimes. But if Alabama is able to run the ball just a little bit, these teams are so evenly matched and they're both so dependent on stopping the run. That, and you're asking basically what's the key on that side of the ball, and you asked me before what's the key on the other side of the ball, is both teams are really just kind of predicated on stopping the run and running the ball. So if one team has more success running the ball, that's the team that's most likely going to win this game. Not to say Jake Fromm and Jalen Hurts can't make up for it on their own, but I kind of see whoever is able to control the line of scrimmage more. And, you know, we always say that. But in this game, it especially matters. And, you know, Georgia's run defense, to kind of repeat the theme of what I was saying on the other side of the ball, mm-hmm. has been really good every game except one, except that first Auburn game. Georgia's able to flip it and do better the second time against Auburn, but Kerryon Johnson wasn't 100% for that game. Alabama's coming in with two healthy tailbacks, so that, you know, that obviously makes you a little bit worried if you're a Georgia fan.
We saw the adjustment in the second half of the Oklahoma game, Seth, that that Georgia really started running more run blitzes to keep Rodney Anderson at bay, on top of really forcing Baker Mayfield into making some quicker decisions. Was that also an adjustment that was made between the first and second games versus the Auburn Tigers as well?
Yeah, it was. I'm not sure they did too much that different. They just kind of, I think on both sides, they were kind of just ready for what they were facing a little bit more. You know, Roquan Smith was a little more involved. He was kind of taken out of the game, the Auburn game, and they found ways to spring him free a little bit. Now Mel Tucker, the defensive coordinator, who's really kind of stepped out of the shadow this year, is in, you know, look, it is sort of Kirby Smart's defense, but he's not the coordinator. Mel Tucker's running it. Mel Tucker had some great halftime adjustments, and you know, he made some adjustments from the first Auburn game to the second game. But this game, they kind of go in knowing what they're going to deal with. So I'm not sure there's so much adjusting that's going to happen this game. It's just going to be more kind of how you execute right from the get-go.
Tyler Clark is a big body along that defensive line for the Georgia Bulldogs. Just how important a factor is he for the success of this defense?
Well, he's a guy that's really emerged. He's a sophomore. If you'd asked people before the season, the defensive lineman that was going to kind of emerge this year, if one was going to, you know, in a typical 3-4, it's just hard to really make a name for yourself a lot. They would have said Trenton Thompson, who had like 3 sacks in the Liberty Bowl win over TCU. But Thompson's, you know, kind of had some nagging injuries this year. He's playing, but he's not playing up to kind of how it was expected. But Tyler Clark kind of stepped into that role. They have John Atkins, who's one of those underappreciated nose tackles, you know, 310-pound guy that just clogs the middle. He's a fifth-year senior. You know, they're loaded with talent all over that defense, much of it recruited either specifically by Jeremy Pruitt or while Jeremy Pruitt was the defensive coordinator at Georgia for those 2 years. And it's a really experienced defense back there. It's, you know, Roquan Smith, the junior, but he plays like a senior, and he has since he entered the starting lineup. And, you know, you've got seniors kind of almost everywhere else in the secondary and the front seven.
Seth Emerson covers Georgia sports for Dog Nation and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Follow him on Twitter at Seth W. Emerson. Last couple things here, Seth. First off, there are rivalries throughout the Southeastern Conference, but Georgia and Alabama don't meet all that often. Since Saban has been in Tuscaloosa, he is 3-1 versus the Dogs. Is this a rivalry game at all? And if so, why?
I think it is. I mean, they're just in different divisions. Unlike Georgia and Auburn, which play every year because they're considered a geographic rival and a historic rival. Alabama and Georgia don't play every year, but they recruit the same players.
Okay,
you know, and they are geographically kind of close enough that there's a lot of overlap. I mean, there's a lot of Alabama fans in the Atlanta area. You know, a lot of them are probably front runners and bandwagon people, to be honest. But there's also people that have just kind of moved into the Atlanta area or into Georgia. So those other games have been so high profile. The blackout game in 2008 was just a real big high profile game that obviously Georgia got splattered. 2012 was a classic, instant classic game, achingly heartbreaking for Georgia. That people still talk about. I wrote about it yesterday. And the 2015 game was this highly anticipated game where Georgia finally thought they had him. Alabama was coming off a loss. Georgia was unbeaten and putting up a lot of points, and the game was in Athens, and yet Alabama splattered them again. So Alabama's just a nemesis that Georgia can't beat. But now they've got, you know, the one difference between now and those previous Alabama games with Nick Saban is that Kirby Smart's on a different sideline. So the storyline, if Georgia wins tonight, is going to be, hey, changing of the guard. If it's really true, we'll see that years down the line. But if Georgia wins, that's going to be the takeaway for a lot of people. But if Alabama wins, no matter whether it's a splattering or a heartbreaker for Georgia, the storyline's going to be, oh, Georgia's not there yet. Still, you know, Saban's still their nemesis.
And that leads us to our final question for Seth Emerson, covering Georgia sports for Dog Nation and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Who do you got tonight?
I hate making predictions. I was ordered to make one by my bosses, and I picked Alabama. I picked a fairly close one, 27-21. I just think when two teams are mirror images of each other, the team that has the most talent usually wins out. And I think most people would agree that although Georgia has closed the gap, especially with the help of Jeremy Pruitt and Mark Richt's last two recruiting classes, that Alabama still has more talent and more depth. But the talent differential is close enough that no one should be shocked that Georgia wins this game, especially because I've watched this team this year. They make the plays when they need to. They've just, again, not only Jake Fromm, but this whole team just kind of has that it factor. And we'll see if it runs out. But ultimately, I mean, if you ask me to put my kids' college savings on a team, I go with Alabama because of a little bit more talent. And it's not like there's a style difference in this game.
To stay in the know on Georgia sports, follow him on Twitter at Seth W. Emerson. Also read his work at Dog Nation. Also the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Seth, thank you so much for the time today. Really appreciate it.
Sure thing.
All right, that is Seth Emerson sharing the Georgia perspective on tonight's big matchup. And he has me a little bit more fired up that we're going to see some more scoring in this game than I think BK and I agreed upon over the first 2 hours of today's show. We shall see. Kickoff tonight at 7 o'clock. Coming up next, it is Shooting the Bull, including the latest examples of why technology is going to slaughter us humans when they finally decide, to wage that war. You're listening to Midday with Trey and No BK right here on the Horn.
One threw a party in the county jail. was there, they began to wail. The band was jumping and the joint began to swing. You should have heard your knocked out jailbird sing that rock.
Back here on Midday with Trey and BK. Adam is celebrating one of his idols' birthdays. Elvis would have been, I don't know, what, like 85 or so? Wags?
I don't know. I don't have the ticker on him, but, man, he's the greatest.
Greatest according to some, and you understand why hearing music like this. Not necessarily always my cup of tea. There is some Elvis that I appreciate, but plenty of people that are big Elvis fans. I mean, there is an entire park devoted to Elvis Presley. Have you ever been to Graceland?
I have not. I don't get out much, Dre.
All right. Well, I figured it's...
So I have to understand in Iraq, though.
Maybe when you were traveling from Baltimore to Austin or Austin to Baltimore and back again, if you still have family there, perhaps you and the family at some point will take a stop.
It is definitely on my list.
Okay.
For sure.
All right. So on Saturday, the Texas Longhorns traveled up to Waco to take on the Baylor Bears in men's basketball. And what started out looking pretty good for those Longhorns turned into a 69-60 defeat. Texas led 40-38 at halftime, but in the second half, they only managed 20 points in a 9-point loss. And Wags, I'm going to keep you in on the conversation here for this one, because as good as individuals on Texas looked throughout the game, especially Jace Febres in the first half, having a career game from behind the arc and also shooting twos for that matter.
Moved very well without the ball.
Moved very well without the ball, and I thought that this Texas offense in the first half especially did a much better job of getting movement both with the ball and then without the ball inside the 3-point line, and that's what led to them being able to score 40 points in the first half. However, in the second half, Baylor did what Brad Kellner has talked about over the last month or so, and that is the game plan for defeating this Texas team is slowing things to a crawl. Baylor did a great job of that in the second half. Texas got itself totally out of rhythm on the offensive end. The press was not effective enough, and Baylor comes away with a 69-60 win.
Yeah, you guys said it best. I think the recipe to beat Texas is to slow the game, slow the pace down, force them to maintain and play half-court basketball. They did a great job in the first half against Baylor, but in the second half, almost 50% of their production, point production, was down. I mean, you said it yourself. 20 points in the second half compared to their 40 points that they got in the first half.
Texas went scoreless over the final 5 minutes of this game. They shot 2-for-16 to end the game. Kerwin Roach, Dylan Osetkowski, Matt Coleman, they all struggled. Matt Coleman's stats probably looked a little bit better than the other two guys, but all three of those guys are needed if this team is going to win games like this. And Baylor now, even though it was a team that started 0-2 in conference, every single one of their losses this year has been to a ranked opponent, and it really looked like that playing against a Texas team that is still trying to find itself. Andrew Jones misses another game, although he's recovered from that wrist injury. There's something else going on there right now. Texas not sure if and when they're going to get him back, so our thoughts are with Andrew Jones and his family right now. And on the offensive end, Texas did have 11 assists to go along with 11 turnovers. The 1-to-1 assist to turnover ratio is not going to cut it in most contests. They did force 15 Baylor turnovers, but despite what Febres was able to do behind the 3-point line, Texas only shot 31% from 3-point range, so a lot more of the same of what we've seen out of this team all year long. Just not being able to make shots from downtown and not doing enough to really work things inside. They only shot 34% as a whole, and that's not going to be enough to get it done against ranked opponents, much less a Baylor team that finds itself outside of the top 25 right now.
Right. I agree with every point that you made there. For me, man, I love the energy that Texas brings out, and that always resonates with Kerwin Roach. I love Roach. I just think we need a shooter. All right, Texas yeah. needs a shooter. With Roach, you know what you're going to get. It's hustle play, a lot of blacktop basketball. Great for top high-paced games, but the MO is out. Slow Texas down. It looked to me like Kerwin was getting some decent looks in the paint, but he was still, it looked hesitant. He looked very hesitant and not confident with his shot. The little baby hooks and stuff, I'm done with that, man. Give a strong pump fake, get the guy up in the air, and then get up, maybe get a point, a foul and an and one chance.
Texas missed a lot of chippies in this one. I think you're right. At times, Kerwin Roach tries to do a little bit too much. He realizes that there is an onus on the offensive end, especially at shooting guard. That's a position that he is a part of right now, even though when Eric Davis and Jacob Young are out there, or even Jace Febres, those guys all really qualify as that wing type of position, the non-point guard position on the floor. And it looked like Kerwin Roach was just trying to do a little bit too much at times, which has been the case throughout this season when you have seen him struggle. Look, he's taken his game to the next level as far as the defender is concerned, and it looks like he is close to turning the corner on the offensive end as well. And then you see a game like this, and it kind of feels like Kerwin Roach has stepped back to square one now. Mo Bamba had a decent second half, but overall he was outplayed by Lual Achiuwil, the senior post player for the Baylor Bears. Achiuwil did have 17 points, also 6 rebounds, and then 4 block shots as well. Mo Bamba got most of his production in the second half, so if anything, he was really helping keep this Texas team in the ball game. But Texas needs to see a more assertive Mo Bamba in the first halves of games. Even though Texas was leading going into halftime, they were doing so without their primary pieces contributing like they normally do, which is one of those things that just shows how a good bulk shooter, if he does heat up, can really carry your team a long ways.
Right, and I think this will come in time. Once Bamba gets a little bit more meat and size on him, too, he'll be able to actually own that paint and be able to go up strong. For me, we've been talking about Kerwin Roach. Matt Coleman, all right, like another freshman, great potential, a lot of upswing, but you got to shoot the rock. You got to shoot the rock. You got to do more than just distribute, man. I get it. You're the point guard, and I know that's your role. But point guards today can distribute and they can score. We need someone that can take the ball into their hands. If the team can't do it, you have to be the one that's scoring.
He's still trying to develop that scoring game, and although you've seen him hit outside shots this year, that is not his forte. He does a decent job of getting the ball inside and not only finding open guys, but making those little floaters, making the chippies, getting all the way to the bucket and making a layup. But Matt Coleman has a shot that is in progress right now. You saw that yesterday, 0 of 3 from behind the 3-point line, 3 of 9 total. He did have 5 assists, but also 3 turnovers to go along with that as well. Just scored 6 points, but you're right, Adam. The point guard position has elevated them in games that they've won this year, specifically Matt Coleman being able to score points against good competition. They've got to find scoring wherever they can right now, especially if Dylan Osatkowski is going 3 of 12, including 2 of 7 from the 3-point line. Eric Davis had a couple of good games in a row. He was 1 of 5 from deep, also 1 of 8 in the game. He missed a couple of easy lay-ins that Mo Bamba was there to actually clean up that slop. But they just have to find more guys, especially with Andrew Jones potentially out an extended amount of time now, to get the ball in the bucket consistently. I just don't know if they have that, and that could lead to a long conference play season for this Longhorn squad.
Yeah, I agree. I love D-Ski, or Dylan Osakowski, is I call him D-Ski. Mm-hmm. It's just, for me, man, I love the game that he brings, but when you're the second best three-point shooter on the team and you're the second biggest guy on the team, That doesn't bode well for me. Get inside, man. I know you can shoot the rock. Do that when you get to the NBA. Right now, we need your points in the paint. Help out Bamba. Help him get big. Show him a little bit of more of a physical presence in the paint. Help him distribute that as well. Man, you got to stay inside.
It's interesting, too, because Shaka Smart talks about him in practice and how he is the best three-point shooter on this team in practice. And I hear that, and it is slightly encouraging. After all, the previous game, you did see him shoot 7 of 13 at Iowa State. However, to what you're talking about as well, you have to have your post presence down low to really, for spacing sake, if nothing else, on the basketball court. So, yes, Dylan Osatkowski can shoot the basketball at times. We haven't seen that consistently this year, though. So, part of me feels like this is one of those, well, Shaquille O'Neal shoots 80% on free throws in practice. He just can't translate that to the game. Dylan Osatkowski can be a good three-point shooter, but there has to be a certain point where all of a sudden you're changing your offensive strategy and not allowing him to shoot nearly as much from outside. If you're seeing that he doesn't have it going from the outside, you don't let him keep doing that. That's how you really evolve your game plan within the game itself.
And for the love of God, if he is going to shoot some threes, if he's going to stay out there on the arc, Bamba, you got to stay inside, brother. You can't be floating out to. This can't be a three-point happy shooting team. We're not the Golden State Warriors. We're just not.
Unfortunately, that looks like the personality of this team this year. And once you get into conference play, it is very difficult to change who you are. But that might be the reality of the situation as it pertains to rooting for Texas basketball going forward. They need a more physical Mo Bamba. If they can get a Jericho Sims or an Eric Davis or a Jacob Young going on any given night, that's great. Kerwin Roach continuing to drive to the bucket, finding ways to finish like he has at times this year, as well as Matt Coleman doing what he does from the point guard position, which is a marked improvement versus where this team was last year at point guard. All of those things can contribute to this team doing much better. I'm also a little bit curious that Jacob Young didn't play at all in the game. I didn't hear a reason as to why. Perhaps it was a coach's decision. Maybe there's an illness or something else going on along those lines. Royce Hamm ended up playing a couple of minutes in this one. And then you also saw Jericho Sims for a limited number of minutes. He played 13 minutes and didn't do a whole lot in either end. Picked up a couple of rebounds. So that is it for Texas basketball right now. All right, it's time for Shooting the Bull.
Shooting the Bull.
Shooting the Bull is sponsored by Tom McKay and Audio Visual Consultations. You hear BK and me talk about them all the time. AVConsultations.com is where you should go. Check out the photo gallery. Also, the detailed descriptions of all the different type of work that Audio Visual Consultations can do for you and your home or your place of business. For me, the Elling household now has surround sound in the living room, as well as a mounted 65-inch TV on a wall that we didn't know whether or not we could mount a TV on that wall, because it was isolated from everything else going on. Sure enough, Tom McKay came over. He and his guys saw what was going on. They diagnosed what was needed, and then they got it done. And now my wife and I no longer have to watch TV with the closed captioning on to make sure not to wake up the little ones at night when we're watching sports or movies or TV shows or whatever else. Thank you so much to Tom McKay and Audio Visual Consultations for that. AVConsultations.com, they sponsor Midday with Trey and BK, including Shooting the Bull right now. All right, your future sex robot could be hacked and programmed to murder you. Yes, that is the headline out of the Daily Star. We joke all the time about how Brad Kellner should consider marrying, not marrying a human necessarily, but marrying a robot for the possibility of when the machines and the humans wage war. That way he's on the right side of the battle. We all realize that this is going to be a one-sided affair when computers decide to wage war with the humans. Well, not so fast, BK, because the sex robot craze that has swept the globe may have a flaw. Cybersecurity experts like Dr. Nick Patterson warned that the more advanced these robots get, the greater risk they pose to mankind. Hackers, according to Patterson, can control a robot by hacking into it and have full control of the connections, arms, legs, and other attached tools. Once a robot is hacked, they could then be used to cause all sorts of damage. Wags, any thoughts on that one?
Skynet.
Yeah, Skynet indeed.
What is going, seriously, where are we at today? Like, where are we at in our society to where we're just having, now we're having fantasies and fantasizing about sleeping with robots, and their, you know, malfunctioning parts that they're going to have, and then just all of a sudden come up and kill us. It's awesome. I can't wait. Don't threaten me with a good time.
Yeah, it's a difficult place to be right now, considering just how attached we are physically and emotionally to our technology. I mean, how many times do you walk into a public place and see just everybody else in the room just locked into their phone or their tablet or whatever that piece of technology is, really not paying attention to what else is going on around them?
You strike me as a guy that likes to have conversation at dinner.
I do. I mean, I'm guilty at times also of looking down at my phone a little bit too much, whether it's following Twitter or checking an email or reading something on a website. I mean, it happens for me as well, but, you know, we have a pretty strict no technology policy at the right. Elling dinner table at home. Sometimes the TV is on. I'll admit that the Saints and Panthers were on last night while we were eating dinner, but this is a great excuse, folks. I had to watch that game for my job. And usually when the TV's on for extended time when the kids are up, it's always because of a sporting event.
That's the best excuse in the world.
It really is. Something Texas-related or football season, and the TV's on a lot less when it's not football season. We try to encourage conversation amongst the three-year-old right now. Eventually the one-year-old will be able to contribute a little bit more than the babbling that he's giving us right now. It's a big pet peeve of both my wife and I to be at a table eating with other people and just have them totally ignoring you for that technology.
That and the fact when the phone acts like, you know, the dog, and the dog is walking the human, if the arm is considered the leash, going, especially if you're going across traffic. I will acquiesce, and obviously I'll let pedestrians cross traffic, but at least acknowledge that I'm right next to you and that I could run you over if I wanted to. Yes, I know you have the right of way, but look up, get out of your phone, just get out of your world, man. Pay attention to what's going on around you. The phones, I love my phones, I love technology, but it will be the death of us, dude.
I do have to admit something embarrassing as far as traffic is concerned with my cell phone. When I'm sitting in traffic, when it's stop-and-go traffic, I'm probably on my cell phone to help deal with that excruciating process, especially considering the town that we live in and how much traffic that we have to deal with. You and I specifically, because of how early we have to be in here now in preparation for this show. We both try and be in by, 8 or 9 o'clock? And so that means sitting in rush hour traffic.
360, baby. Gotta love it.
Yeah, 360, Mopac sometimes for me as well. And this just helps me to be able to tune out from that to avoid the otherwise blood pressure building frustrations that come with stopping and going on 360 or Mopac or 183.
It allows me to digress. It allows me to get it at ease myself from the road rage that is starting to easily pile up because the guy in the left hand or the lady in the left hand lane will not even go the speed limit. They just want to block down the flow. I could go a whole day on Austin traffic.
Absolutely. All right, that's it for Shoot of the Bull today. Coming up next, it will be some crosstalk with Rod Babers. You're listening to Midday with Trey and BK. He's not here right now because he's partying in Atlanta for tonight's national championship game. He will be back, though, tomorrow from 10 to noon. The show itself, of course, runs until 1. You're listening to Midday with Trey and BK on the Horn.
We're caught in a trap.
Final segment of Midday with Trey and BK. Brad Kellner in Atlanta right now, partying it up before the championship game, so he is not on these airwaves. But it does mean it's crosstalk with Rod Babers before the Rodcast from 1 to 3. What's up, Rod? How you doing?
What's going on, brother?
Not a lot. Adam Wagner has been playing Elvis Presley all day today because it is the King's birthday. You a big Elvis guy?
I'm not a big Elvis guy, but I'm a fan of good music, and okay. Elvis has got some classics.
That's kind of where I am, too. Yeah. There are certain things. Mm-hmm. I respect him as an artist, I don't necessarily own a ton, but I also have my favorite Elvis songs as well.
Yeah, you got to respect the king. I mean, you got to respect what he did. I mean, what he was doing at the time was, I mean, his hip shaking was, basically said it was going to corrupt America because he was moving his hips too much.
Right.
That's how conservative America was back then. Yeah, we need a little bit of an awakening, and Elvis helped with that.
Considering where we are now, that was an amusing claim to make so many years ago now. Now, going into the weekend, you had mentioned that your weekend might consist of helping nurse the girlfriend back to good health. Was that the majority of your weekend?
Yeah, she took Friday off, but she actually now is back at work and doing well. So I did a good job, man. You just pound vitamin C when you start feeling it coming on. That's what you do.
How are you as a sick person? Do you like other people to be waiting on you hand and foot? Do you like to be left by yourself?
No, man. I get it out of the way. Once I feel it coming on, and I got a strong immune system, I basically drown the sickness right then.
Just put yourself under covers, tell everybody to get out, shut the lights off, and just sleep and sweat it out.
Sleep, vitamin C, a little sweat ain't bad either. Yeah, a lot of water, man. I do it. I'm an athlete, so I always have to get over sicknesses quickly. Like, you didn't have time to get sick. During the season, you feel a cold coming on. You're like, oh, hell no. This thing is not hitting me. By the time game time comes around, I got to drown it. And you go into the training room, and they give you a couple of shots of some good stuff. And boom, you're feeling good.
Speaking of football, it was a big, if not at times boring, weekend in the wild card round of the NFL playoffs. I'm looking at you, Jacksonville and Buffalo.
Wow.
But for the most part, the games themselves were good. Were there any surprises that you saw this weekend that you just did not even come close to foresee happening?
I did not see that Titans comeback happening. Yeah. I mean, and Marcus Mariota, I think on third down, he completed like 71% of his passes, threw two touchdown passes, one to himself. He actually put that team on his back, and he wasn't that great. It was ugly the way he made it happen, but he did it.
That was more about Henry, I think, running the football than it was Mariota throwing it. But I think all of us would have maybe changed our pick, if not to Tennessee outright, at least given them more of a chance, had we known Travis Kelce was going to go down to an injury at the end of the first half, and that was not going to serve as a safety valve for Alex
Kansas
Smith
City,
in the second.
Kansas City will have a new quarterback next year.
Patrick Mahomes. Yeah, he looks good in Week 17. All right, what else is happening on the broadcast today?
We'll get into the Kendall Briles hire at U of H. Now, people are upset about that. And at Art Briles, his speaking engagement with the Football Coaches Association has been canceled due to uproar and blowback.
Art is more egregious than Kendall, correct? Paying him money to do something football-related, right?
In terms of a responsibility and what you're supposed to be accountable for, no question about it.
Especially when the title of the panel is Standing Up in Game Management. Like, that was the it wasn't even about holding yourself accountable. It wasn't about making amends with something that you've done incorrectly. It was basically just standing up for yourself in the face of adversity.
Right? It's like letting OJ do like a speaking engagement to NFL players about anger management. It's like, that's just bad. That was just bad thinking all around. Like, I don't know who thought that was a great idea. They want Art Briles back, this good old Boys Network, though. Jerry Jones has tried to jump on his side. Red McCone. Remember June Jones in the CFL? He got the job, then was fired because of the blowback. Now the American Football Coach Association, they want him back. And they're going to keep pushing. Trust me, the good old Boys Network wants him back, people. They keep pushing for it.
There's going to be too much blowback. Whoever tries to bring him back, he is such a polarizing figure and will continue to be. BK claims that he will be back in the head coaching coaching ranks at some point. I don't buy it.
Billionaires are pushing for him to come back.
He couldn't even last in the CFL for a year.
No, it's going to be
for
tough.
Even a day, you know? He can't even make speeches at coaches associations just yet. So there's at least a little bit more time that's going to be required before Art Briles finds himself back in charge of the lives of young people, and I think we're all better off for that. All right, thank you very much, Rod, for the Rodcast.
Anytime,
and good luck with that over the next couple of hours. Adam Wagner, you did a great job behind the glass today. BK, screw you, man. You skipped out on me in the last hour. Coming up next, it is the Rodcast. In the meantime, you've been listening to Midday with Trey and BK here on the Horn. Thank you.